Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. As this year's elections become more of a merger between a casino and a circus, with billionaire ringmasters offering a competing clown show, we will begin with a discussion about who really runs our country and the world. The CEO and editor-at-large of Foreign Policy magazine, David Rothkopf, joins us to talk about his new book, Power Inc., The Epic Rivalry Between Big Business and Government, and the Reckoning That Lies Ahead. Then we will visit the graveyard of empires, Afghanistan, and discuss the accelerated withdrawal of the U.S. out of one war as pressure builds to get us embroiled in another. Former National Security Staffer Roger Morris, who has written Between the Graves, a history of U.S.-Afghan relations and American policy in South Asia based on thousands of previously secret documents, joins us to look into the latest chapter of America's recent foreign policy misadventures. Then finally, we'll get an update on the surrogate war in Syria, where the Russians and the Iranians, who have been pouring in arms to support the Assad dictatorship, appear to be winning, while the Saudis, in spite of their mountains of money and arms, seem to be backing the losing side. James Gelvin, a specialist on Syria at UCLA, joins us to assess why, as it appears that the Syrian opposition has been routed, does the Obama administration keep insisting Assad will fall? And joining us now is David Rothkopf, who is CEO and editor-at-large of Foreign Policy magazine. He's also president and CEO of Garton Rothkopf and a visiting scholar at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, and the author of Running the World, The Inside Story of the National Security Council and the Architects of American Power, and Superclass, The Global Elite and the World They Are Making. His latest book just out is Power Inc., The Epic Rivalry Between Big Business and Government and the Reckoning That Lies Ahead. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Rothkopf.
Nice to be back.
And the gravity of your book and the reckoning that lies ahead, I must say, is in stark contrast to the sort of game show democracy that we're witnessing here in this presidential cycle with promises of $2 gasoline. It's enough to make you tear your hair out, the gap between the challenges and those that are stepping up to the plate.
Well, I think on one level, the political debate in the U.S. has been debased by what you correctly refer to as a kind of a shift to a game show mentality. It's all a cage match. Things are said for their emotional effect. Things are said so that they stir up the Twitterverse. The extreme superficial ideas really dominate the discussion. I think on another level, though, it's even more pernicious because the people who are driving this are not shallow people. They're people with deep pockets and big checkbooks who are directing the conversation in these shallow directions in order to, in some cases subtly and in some cases directly, advance very clear self-interest.
Well, it's inextricably bound in your new book, Power Inc., David Rothkopf, as a sort of subtext for why we can't advance and why there can't be an alliance or a cooperation between government and industry. The problem is that industry or corporations own the government, and they've owned it through the lack of campaign finance reform, and in fact the reversal with the Supreme Court decision. I mean, we could never in this country deal seriously with the great global challenge of global warming until there's some campaign finance reform, surely.
Well, look, we can't deal successfully with most of the problems we face unless public power and private power are in the right balance. And in fact, throughout most of American history, contrary to the political debate you hear about getting rid of government, our big achievements, canals, railroads, the internet, the space program, highways, a lot of tech advancements, have been through public-private partnership. But sometimes, and recently, over the course of the past several decades, what happens is private power becomes so concentrated that it's able to change the rules in the system, put a heavy thumb on the scale, and instead of government balancing private power on behalf of the people at large, it actually works to advance the interests of a few. Our system is so fundamentally corrupt in terms of the role money plays in it, which is different from any other country in the world, that right now, even prior to the advent of super PACs, we are having the rich determine who the candidates are in both parties and what the agenda is going to be. And we're just seeing the tip of the iceberg with the super PACs. What if this election is close come October? What if they don't have money? What are the parties going to do? They're going to turn to a handful of people for a bunch of big checks. And if you don't think there's a quid pro quo involved in that kind of a transaction, you're not paying attention. Even Barack Obama, who you might see as the advocate against this kind of a movement, has a track record where half of the big bundlers in his campaign have ended up with senior political positions in the United States government.
Well, there is this phenomenon referred to as government sacks, and there was, of course, this cri de coeur from the Goldman Sachs executive who wrote an op-ed in the New York Times that's been getting some attention. It's an extraordinary plea, if you will, and he's basically saying, you know, that it's completely morally corrupt and the environment is toxic. And I think they could extend that to Wall Street, given that, you know, Wall Street is, according to some of the analysts I've spoken to in the oil and gas field, say they're responsible for 30% of the cost of gasoline, which is completely unproductive and hurting the consumer and hurting the recovery. But not to belabor the contrast between that reality and the political debate, you know, we're having this debate about personal morality as opposed to public morality.
Well, exactly. And the personal debate is a distraction, you know, in its best case. In some cases, it's more pernicious than that. I personally, you know, am a little skeptical of Goldman Sachs employees who've been there for a dozen years and all of a sudden have a bad outbreak of conscience, as if somehow the morality within Goldman Sachs has changed dramatically in the course of the past several months. It clearly hasn't over the course of the past several decades. We see the way the system works and the way that Wall Street worked the last crisis. During the Clinton administration, which I served, they said, get off our backs, let us do our thing, let markets take the lead. And we, for whatever reason, and I think we were naive in this, said, okay, we took down Glass-Steagall, they took the lead. And as always happens in markets throughout history, they overreached and there was a crisis. And the phone rang in Washington and they said, you know how we wanted you off our backs? Maybe not so much. Could you help us out here? We could use a little bit of bigger government right now. Then they took the check, and to really show that they had power, once that check cleared, they got back up on their hind legs. They called back and they said, you know what? We'd like you off our backs again. And government got off their backs again. The financial reforms that we've had were a sham. We haven't funded the agencies that are supposed to do the oversight so they could do the oversight in that reform. They're more too big to fail banks today than there were before. The global derivative markets are bigger and riskier than they were before. In other words, the big issues remain. Homeowners have not had their problems addressed, and Wall Street's making record profits. So that is a real sort of case study in how money can co-opt the system, and government cannot serve the interests of the public at large, which is actually its role.
Again, I'm speaking with David Rothkopf, who's CEO and editor-at-large of Foreign Policy Magazine and the author of this new book, Power, Inc., The Epic Rivalry Between Big Business and Government and the Reckoning That Lies Ahead. And before we get into the different forms of capitalism in the world and the competition and where the U.S. stands vis-a-vis China, India, Brazil, etc., just to finish up on this, it seems to me that inherent in this problem where you have, you know, a kind of the power of the oligarchs and a corporate plutonomy, if you will, over a corrupted democracy, it would seem that there's also an attitude, surely, on the part of the super wealthy, the very ones that are putting the money into these super PACs at the moment and determining our political fate. Isn't there a problem here in as much as these titans of industry, whether they're the inheritors like the Koch brothers or the self-made men like Adelson and others, don't they see politicians as political hirelings, that they therefore don't want talented people in politics?
Yeah, I think, look, right now we're seeing globally the leadership failure that has been bought and paid for by elites that don't want particularly strong leaders. You know, there is this kind of subtext that you hear in the political debate. Ron Paul and other people will say it more clearly than others, and they'll say, oh, let's get government out of the way. Let's push back government. If we have smaller government, we, you know, liberty will sweep in. Freedom will follow in its place. But of course, that's not what happens. When government comes out of the way, you create a vacuum, and politics abhors a vacuum just like nature does. And what comes in are the empowered big actors who can take advantage of that vacuum. So when the Kochs write a check and say, we want small government, they ostensibly are advocating liberty for the average guy, but really what they're doing is advocating elbow room for big private interests to do what they want without regulation, without oversight, and without the public having a seat at the table about the economic and social future of the United States.
Well, it's breathtakingly cynical, but nevertheless effective, how in helping fund the Tea Party, they've got this so-called populist movement that's carrying the water for the oligarchy.
Well, it is breathtakingly cynical, although on some level it's just simple self-interest at work. Corporations, private actors are legally obligated to go and serve their shareholders and maximize profits and push back on things that constrain profits. Now, having said that, when people in the Tea Party who are angry at being exploited, are angry at a system where the 99% are not benefiting, angry at a system where even last year, of the first year of this most recent recovery, 93% of the benefits went to the top 1% of the people, they're supporting something that they think is actually going to alleviate their circumstances, and it's not. What it's going to do is it's going to make it worse, and it's going to continue the trends that over the course of the past decade have made it the first in American history where we lost net jobs, in which social inequality got worse, in which income, social mobility went down. We're in a dire situation in which the system is not working the way that it's supposed to nationally, and it's compounded by the fact that on the global stage, in some cases, this power imbalance is even worse.
Again, I'm speaking with David Rothkopf, who is CEO and editor-at-large of Foreign Policy Magazine and the author of the new book just out, Power, Inc., The Epic Rivalry Between Big Business and Government and the Reckoning That Lies Ahead. Now, it does seem as something of an irony that the United States, after World War II, when it was pretty much the last man standing and pretty much unscathed, except arguably for Hawaii, you had the Japanese and the Germans were defeated, but the U.S. brought them back and in many ways gave them the kind of institutions or the government, the private-public relationship that in many ways you're arguing about here, David Rothkopf. I mean, there's no question that the Japanese private-public model, and to some extent the Korean, all the way through the so-called Tigers, have proven very successful. And the German model, where unions have seats on the boards of directors, have made that one of the world's most successful, if not the world's most successful, export economy. So what happened here? What's good for our rivals is not good for us? That we export a better system than the one we have at home?
Well, first of all, those systems are colored by their culture and key questions that are asked within the context of that culture. What is community? Why do we have government? Why do we serve one another? What are our goals? In some respects, you know, they had an advantage. They no longer were mesmerized, as we have been recently, with the idea of being number one, being the most powerful nation on earth, and they could focus instead. They weren't also, you know, caught up in the kind of funding the defense beast as we have been caught up in it, and they were able to focus on what do we do to improve quality of life, what do we do to improve the people at large, how do we do this in the context of our culture. We, on the other hand, bought into this notion that in order to be successful, we must be the biggest, most powerful nation on earth, that we must spend the most on defense. And then we bought into this notion that small government, deregulation, pushing back, and leaving it to the markets was really the thing that was working for us, even though in 200 years of American history, that's actually not the case. And from the 1980s and Reagan and Thatcher, Anglo-American capitalism started putting out a notion that if we just lowered taxes, pushed government out of the way, reduced regulation, that everybody would prosper. Except we now have several decades of looking at this. That's not what happens. And then there was a twist. The Cold War ended, and at the end of the Cold War, we were celebrating our victory over, you know, communism, and we thought the competition was over, but a new competition was starting between systems, such as the ones that you've mentioned, and ours, competition among capitalism's alternative models. And today, you've got capitalism with Chinese characteristics, you've got European capitalism, very different in the South and in the North of Europe. You've got democratic development capitalism in big countries like India and Brazil. You've got small states that are very entrepreneurial, like Singapore or Israel or the United Arab Emirates, that act a lot like countries more than they do like, I mean, companies more than they do like countries. And so what you've ended up with here is a lot of other versions, and all of them have a bigger role for government in ensuring competitiveness, and a bigger role for government in providing a safety net, and a bigger role for government in empowering people to succeed than we do. In fact, none of them are having the kind of extremist debates that we have in the U.S., where people credibly stand up and say, we shouldn't have government, we shouldn't have public education, we shouldn't have an EPA, we shouldn't have regulation. These thoughts would never even cross their minds.
But in terms of the trajectory of the U.S. since World War II, is it a case that the empire has taken over the republic, or at least, you know, the republic is being threatened by the empire? Is it that simple?
Well, I don't think it's that simple, but I think that's certainly the case. I mean, you know, look, if you look out over the course of the past several decades of American history, we've collectively made a choice. Perhaps not consciously, but if you look at democracy and you're a historian in 200 years determining what our choices were through our democratic system, we've decided that we are going to take the majority of the discretionary resources that we've got, that is everything that, you know, isn't tied up in an entitlement, and the biggest chunk of that, year after year after year, we're going to invest in defense. We're going to invest in spending more money on the military than every other major power in the world added up. Well, that's a choice. And it means we're not going to spend it on education or health care or highways or improving opportunities for the poor or taking care of the elderly. We're going to devote it on power and not on leadership. And I think that that is a choice that ultimately is costing us greatly.
So, David Rothkopf, do you think that could be reversed in terms of some kind of political leadership or somebody stepping up and creating this platform? Because one of the things I find sort of pernicious and depressing about all of this is, as you've described it, the decline of our standard of living and our quality of life at the expense of being the global superpower. What's happened is a kind of public relations injection of jingoism to distract us from these realities. So we have a phony patriotism that tells us how we're doing so great, when in reality we're not. Is there any possibility that we can have a kind of national referendum about what it really means to be an American? What going back to that, when I was talking earlier about public morality versus private morality, you know, a kind of reality check on where we stand?
First of all, I certainly think there's some encouraging signs. First of all, the United States is a country where the Constitution was brilliantly conceived of in order to enable us to reinvent ourselves. And we've done it in sweeping ways. 100 years ago, we were an agrarian country. 100 years later, we were an industrial country. We were a rural country. We became an urban country. We were an uneducated country. We became the world leader in higher education. We have reinvented ourselves regularly, so there's no reason why we couldn't do it again. Secondly, you know, there have been some encouraging subtexts in the U.S. political debate, whether it's the Occupy movement and the Tea Party at least starting to express the politics of alienation and say, no, we can't have this system go on, or Barack Obama saying the election's going to be about fairness, or Mitt Romney saying the election's going to be a debate about capitalism. You know, you could have two fairly reasonable, moderate candidates having a discussion about this issue in a fairly substantive way if it turns out in a certain kind of way. That said, neither Mitt Romney nor Barack Obama is going to be the change agent this system needs. We are one crisis shy of clarity about what we need to do, whether it's in the national level in terms of rebalancing power, or at the global level in terms of saying, look, you know, there are a couple thousand corporations out there that are better able to operate on the global stage than most companies and countries, and we don't have the regulatory and counterbalancing mechanisms on the global stage that we do within nations, and we can't project the ones that we've got within our borders out onto the global stage. And that creates a real problem when so many of the fundamental issues in the social contract require global decisions and global action in order to be fulfilled. So the ability to make change is there. But I don't see the impetus towards, you know, a game changer, HBO movies aside, that we really, you know, that we really need to have. And in fact, I think one of the ironies of that HBO movie game change is that it was not about a game change. It was about the same old game. It was about money winning the debate. It was about the candidate with the most money from Wall Street, beating the candidate who didn't quite have as much money. Our country in sore need of a game change, that's for sure.
Right. And also it's about a debate that's not driven by facts and data, but by ideology and spin. And, you know, gone are the days when William F. Buckley debated his good friend George McGovern.
Well, gone are the days, you know, look, you know, I wrote a book that's a history because I wanted to look back and I wanted to say how much of this is a historical trend. And because that's going to mean, you know, we will understand how hard it is to change. And in fact, many of these things have been afoot for a long time. The empowerment of companies, artificial persons, to the point that they now have essentially the inalienable rights of human beings and then some, because they're immortal, bigger, better able to operate globally. The Supreme Court keeps endowing them with more and more rights and prerogatives. This is a bigger issue that's about how society is organized, and whether it's during the Glorious Revolution in England, or the American Revolution, the French Revolution, 1848, even earlier in the 20th century, there were debates about what kind of society we wanted to have, why we were organized this way. Was it about being number one, or was it about offering a better quality of life to people? We need to get back to that debate first. We need to figure out what kind of society we want to be, and then shape the system to serve that objective, rather than allowing the system to be shaped by people who are serving their self-interest.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, David Rothkopf.
Thank you very much.
And, you know, we barely scratched the surface with your book, so all the more reason for people to get it, because there's an awful lot of original thought and ideas, and I congratulate you on it.
Thank you very much.
Again, I've been speaking with David Rothkopf, who's CEO and editor-at-large of Foreign Policy Magazine. He is the author of a number of books. His latest just out is Power, Inc., The Epic Rivalry Between Big Business and Government and the Reckoning That Lies Ahead. I'm going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about the graveyard of empires, Afghanistan. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Roger Morris, who served in the United States Foreign Service and on the senior staff of the National Security Council under both Presidents Lyndon Johnson and Richard Nixon until resigning over the invasion of Cambodia. His latest book, Between the Graves, is about the history of U.S.-Afghan relations and American policy in South Asia based on thousands of previously secret documents. He's also at work on a comparative history of the inner politics of the United States and Soviet Russia. Welcome to Background Briefing, Roger Morris.
Thank you, Ian.
And the conversation I just had with David Rothkopf in many ways was about whether or not the Republic will survive the Empire. And also in the context of this year's election, which is more and more appears like a merger between a casino and a circus, with billionaire ringmasters offering competing clown shows. This couldn't be, I think, more of a dire disconnect than the challenges that we face and the quality of the people who are offering themselves up as leaders.
Well, I think the comparison is apt. I would suggest that most Las Vegas casinos have more sophisticated clown shows than this Republican primary has been. I think you're absolutely right that that it's a countdown between the extinction of the Republic and at least some control of the empire. The two obviously are utterly incompatible. Much of the Republic is of course a casualty to the way we've organized our domestic politics, as your previous guest pointed out. The system has triumphed. On the other hand, it could not be sustained and would not be as abusive without this this foreign policy of imperial overreach.
So, do you think there's a chance, though, of a real debate in this country of this phony patriotism that is to do with, you know, wrapping ourselves in the flag, supporting our troops, but not questioning what in God's name we're doing out there in the world, and this America First stuff, when America is not first in most of the indicators of a wealthy, civilized, livable country. We're in many by many indexes, we're going down and down.
You know, I think it's easy to be very, very pessimistic about what we face and what we're seeing now as the manifestation of the political system. I would just salvage, I think, two somewhat more hopeful developments in answer to your question, Ian. First, I think there has been, on the right, a reaction in the more responsible intellectual circles of American conservatism against this spectacle, against the sheer demagoguery, even against the outlandish tyranny of money in the process, and the sheer know-nothing quality of the candidates for the Republican nomination, an insult to the history of that party, even at its worst. And I think that one finds among the more responsible, the more traditional conservative commentators, a pull back and a push back from that, which conceivably might lead to a somewhat more responsible dialogue in the wake of what I think is going to be a rather ignominious defeat in this presidential election. The second, and I think even more encouraging development, is that we do have potentially here a different Barack Obama in his second term. It's not likely, I don't regard it as probable, but at least it's possible that for the first time in his life, relieved of the imperatives of ambition and advance and concession and accommodation, which have been, of course, his MO throughout his life, relieved of that, it's conceivable that he could become a more dynamic leader. And the leadership would have to begin, of course, not only with a more responsible domestic policy and surrounding himself with more mature and responsible advisors, but also a more responsible foreign policy. And he's going to be forced, back to our original topic here, he's going to be forced into a major reassessment of Afghanistan. And, of course, the looming problem of Iran after the election will be there, and that has the most dire implications. He will be, however, much more of a free agent at that point, at January 20th, 2013, than he is now. And that, at least, is some small reason to hope. But none of that relieves us of the duty, I think, to mount and mobilize all the pressure possible, and a more sophisticated and targeted pressure than progressive forces have been capable of so far.
Well, Roger Morris, I'm not sure that on the Republican side there are any indications of moderation. I mean, Olympia Snow just quit the party because she could no longer work in it. There was no middle ground anymore. And Lugar, who's one of the more sensible senators, he's been forced to vote further and further to the right. They're all looking over their shoulder at the Tea Party radicals. It seems in many ways, I don't know whether you saw the HBO movie, but it seems in many ways that John McCain opened the door to a new Republican Party that Sarah Palin has ushered in, which is, you know, the party of people, you know, just like you and me, you know, where we're not voting for anymore for qualified people. We're voting for people that, you know, are just like us.
Well, I think this. I think you're absolutely right. I think the system is intact. What I was talking about really was the beginning, at least, of a small backlash in the intellectual dialogue, such as it is, the discourse of the Republican Party. But I think you're absolutely right. The political system, the congressional party, certainly is unchanged. The electoral party is worse than ever. I think you're right that the 2008 election opened the door to that, and certainly Palin's candidacy was historic in that sense. It really legitimized that awful know-nothing rump, which has always been there. They were there, of course, throughout the 30s and 40s and in the post-war period. They've never enjoyed more power. They've never been better financed. But I think we should be honest and say that they were also helped enormously by this administration, by the Obama bungling of the first 2 years, which led to the 2010 midterms, which gave us this incredibly regressive, reactionary Congress. And I mean, this is a bipartisan atrocity, and their success is to some extent the product of the utter bankruptcy of the Democrats.
So, just turning to foreign policy, which is what we were supposed to talk about, but I find this very interesting. Nevertheless, the latest chapter of America's most recent foreign policy misadventures appears to be shutting down in Afghanistan, but at the same time, more and more pressure is put on Obama to start a new war with Iran. You were mentioning a minute ago that if he gets reelected as of January, January the 21st, he would not be, I assume, would not be beholden to AIPAC anymore and wouldn't have to be taunted by Netanyahu.
Well, I think that's right. Although, you know, he will be certainly looking at his place in history. The Israel lobby will still have enormous power to block him legislatively and to punish his posterity, as it were, to punish his legacy in a number of ways. I mean, it's going to be if he chooses to challenge them with that new independence, it's going to be a titanic battle. There's no question about that. But he will have a reelected Obama will have new independence, and I would assume that he may well have a majority in both houses of Congress. And if that's the case, a more solid majority in the Senate, which looks at least possible now for the first time in a while, and a recapture of the House, then he is a different political creature. But as I said, the world's not going to wait on him. The Israelis are certainly capable of doing something unilaterally, and their approach to all of this is quite irrational, self-destructive, but nonetheless, I'm afraid, quite dangerous.
So what confidence do you have, though, that America is still operates on data and facts and not ideology and ignorance in the sense that you expect, I assume, and I'm reading into what you're saying, Roger Morris, is that the majority of the American voters and the independents will vote for the Democrats this time because they are appalled at the insanity on the Republican side. I just
it will be the classic lesser of evils election once again. But I, unless something really changes, Ian, I can't see any candidate on the Republican side. Certainly not Santorum and not Romney at his most revived, which is again hard to imagine. Really defeating Obama. Now that doesn't mean it's not going to be a very, very close race in some of these so-called swing states.
But you're talking about them picking up a bigger majority in the Senate and taking back the House. That's going to require a kind of shift in the country. And I'm just wondering whether the country whether we are on a trajectory towards more ignorance as opposed to less.
Well, I wanted to be a bit optimistic since I'm always pretty doomsday with you. I think the odds are against that kind of positive development still. If you ask whether fear and ignorance will prevail, I would have to say at this point, yes, that's quite likely. You know, we have these parallel universes in the national dialogue, certainly in foreign policy, and the Iranian nuclear issue is a classic case of that, where the American intelligence community knows full well, or seems to be quite confident, as a dispatch in the New York Times this morning points out, that the Iranians had halted their nuclear program. There were some misgivings from intercept evidence and other sources that there might have been an attempt to restart it, but they're still banking very heavily on the fact that they have not resumed a weaponization program. There's that element of the national discourse, which of course is the official intelligence version. There's a public dialogue of former officials, retired military officers, et cetera, warning against a war with Iran, warning against acting on false intelligence. And then there is this other universe entirely, which operates in part at the behest of the Israel lobby, in part out of the sheer dementia and really militarism of the American right. And the utterly irresponsible positions of the Republican presidential candidates, all of course pandering for Jewish money and for the support of the Israel lobby. But this is going to be a very close run thing, and I don't know that unless Obama summons extraordinary courage, unlike any he has shown ever in his career. And extraordinary insight with new people around him. I don't think he's going to prevail.
So, Roger Morris, then, what do you think is going to happen vis-a-vis Iran as we shut down in Afghanistan? By the way, I spoke with a captain the other day who was his platoon. He led had the highest casualty since Gettysburg, 80% casualties on the border with Pakistan and Afghanistan. He said that after the battles, they would pick up the enemy's weapons, and they were all brand new, made in Iran weapons. So obviously Iran's having some schadenfreude at our expense, but they're also basically keeping Assad going. According to these emails that have somebody hacked into the Assad emails, and it seems like the Iranians are literally running the show there, along with the Russians. So there's some dimensions of a kind of surrogate war going on there. And if we were to strike Iran, of course, that would be a huge victory for Assad and the Russians. So is there any chance of any sort of deft foreign policy here on the part of the United States?
Well, I think there has to be obviously a major reassessment of what kind of Middle East balance of power we want. The Iranians are not doing, for that matter, anything very new here in terms of their covert war against the United States. They have been supplying weapons in Afghanistan. They're certainly behind Assad. They're very active now. We know in the Yemen. In a covert action against the United States. I mean, mean, there, that of course is an almost predictable outcome of having to limit their nuclear ambitions and their ambitions to be a regional power and to balance off the Israelis will not wane, will not disappear simply because they may give up for the time being their nuclear weapons program. So we can expect that challenge in covert ways as well as other means for some time to come. And I think, again, it depends on how Obama and the people around him define the American national interest in a new Middle East. And this Arab Spring, which we were so happy to see, which has turned into a rather chilly Arab winter, is going to drag on with uncertain consequences. We still have the Saudis to cope with at a number of levels. So this is a very, very complicated picture. It's probably more challenging in some respects than any American president has faced since World War II. And a second term for Obama is going to bring all of this right up to his doorstep almost right away.
Well, but what seems to be simple and straightforward about all of these is that there's a pretty universal desire on the part of the peoples of these countries, whether they're Iran or Syria or Egypt or really anywhere in the Middle East, for more freedom. And at the same time, there's also the ruthlessness of the dictatorships, whether they're the Saudi kings or the Assads or the mad mullahs in Tehran.
Well, I think we often make the mistake, of course, of an old-fashioned version of the domino theory that all of these countries are somehow the same, and that if Mubarak goes in Cairo, that the same thing is going to happen, or if Gaddafi is eventually overthrown in Libya, the same thing is going to happen in Syria or somewhere else. That, of course, is not the case. The system is very different. The societies and culture are very different. The array of power in Syria is much more complicated. The Alawis are a very powerful force in command of the army and have a huge economic and social tribal stake, really, in maintaining their power and a huge fear of what would follow any overthrow of that regime. So that's the systems, as you say, the systems of tyranny are proving much more resilient in this set of countries now that we're looking at. Even in Yemen, where that civil war has been going on for really a half century, I found it very ironic that the Iranians now, according to recent reports, have begun to arm and to train the Shia tribal forces in North Yemen. Those were our allies. We were covertly involved there, of course, against Nasser all the way back in the 1960s. John Kennedy and Lyndon Johnson conducted that covert intervention. So the alliances shift, but the arenas stay very much the same.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Roger Morris.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Roger Morris, who served in the United States Foreign Service and on the senior staff of the National Security Council under both Presidents Lyndon Johnson and Richard Nixon until resigning over the invasion of Cambodia. His latest book, Between the Graves, is about the history of U.S.-Afghan relations and American policy in South Asia based on thousands of previously secret documents. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking with UCLA Professor James Galvin about the apparent losing side, which is the Syrian National Army.
All times I sing, where have all the young men gone? Long time ago, where have all the young men gone? Gone for soldiers to return. When will they ever learn? When will they
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is James Galvin, who's a professor of history at UCLA. His research focuses on the Middle East, particularly Greater Syria, the area of present-day Syria, Lebanon, Jordan, Israel, and the Palestinian territories. He's the author of Divided Loyalties, Nationalism, and Mass Politics in Syria at the Close of Empire and the Modern Middle East, A History. Welcome to Background Briefing, James Galvin.
Thank you for having me.
And tell me about why, James Galvin, are the Saudis, who have mountains of money and piles of arms, somehow on the losing end of this surrogate war, in the surrogate civil war, I guess, in Syria, and conversely, the Russians and the Iranians, who have been apparently conducting massive airlifts into across Iraq into Syria, they seem to be holding up Bashar al-Assad.
Well, you're right. I mean, at this point, it does appear that Bashar's forces are on the offensive. They've been able to retake Homs, the Idlib, and now they've focused their attention in the south in Daraa. I'm not quite sure, however, that if we look at it in terms of why is it the Russians are winning and the Saudis are losing, that that's really going to answer our questions. The reason why, first of all, we don't know what the Saudis are really doing in terms of aid and materiel into Syria. But the forces now, the government forces, are far better equipped, far better armed. They're organized military force as opposed to the Free Syrian Army. The Free Syrian Army is hardly an army. It's a pickup force. It's a group of militias that are operating somewhat in together. But for the most part, there is really no chain of command that connects all the various units that are fighting. So there's only so much that an outside power can do to influence events such as those taking place now in Syria.
Well, speaking of an outside power influencing, the United States, who the administration keeps saying that Bashar al-Assad will fall, they apparently, Barack Obama tried interceding with Iraqi Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki to block the Iranian transport flights to Syria. Apparently, they've been flying record amounts of material they fly across Iraq, Obama's not being able to get the Iraqis help out, which I guess just makes you realize how George W. Bush, Dick Cheney, Condoleezza Rice, Rumsfeld, and all the neoconservatives should be put on trial in this country for their utter stupidity.
Oh, yes. I mean, there's no doubt about it. We can actually look at the decline of America in the region and the emergence of Iran as a regional hegemon in terms of 2003 when we invaded Iraq. There had been a balance of power that the United States had encouraged during the 1970s, 80s, all the way up between Iraq and Iran. As a matter of fact, during the Iran-Iraq War, the United States shared intelligence with Iraq in order to hold Iran back. What we did was we collapsed a very, very strong, ruthless, but very, very strong dictatorship in Iraq and replaced it with an extraordinarily weak government that's incapable of even ruling its own territory. So not only does it not pose a threat to Iran, but it also poses an opportunity to Iran. Iran itself is able to meddle into Iraqi affairs like it never had before.
So my understanding is that you know, there have been these bombings in Damascus yesterday and in Aleppo today. There was also apparently a busload of pro-Iranian militia, pro-Iranian Palestinians militia were also killed and targeted. It's difficult to know whether who this is. You know, could be the regime itself. Not in the case of blowing up the busload of Palestinians, but it could be the Saudis or some effort to try and shore up the opposition. The morale of the opposition has got to be pretty low. Apparently, they've been driven out of Syria into Turkey largely. I'm hearing now that the Saudis have put pressure on the Jordanians to open up arms trafficking. I'm just surprised that that for all of the alleged arms and support that was coming in from Saudi and Qatar, which we'd heard about previously, it doesn't seem like it amounted to much, and certainly nothing much in the way of anti-tank weapons, which you'd imagine. Of course, the Saudis would have plenty of that.
You raise a number of very interesting points. First, about the explosions that have taken place recently in Damascus and Aleppo. We really don't know who is behind it. It could be any one of a number of culprits. And I'm in touch with people, and they are pointing fingers in all sorts of directions. There is even rumors about al-Qaeda and al-Qaeda-type jihadi groups, like the Jabhat, for example, the Front for the Defense of the Syrian People, that has emerged recently, since January, which is a jihadi group. You also have the Free Syrian Army. You have the regime itself that, you know, has been accused by the opposition of manufacturing these incidents. So we really don't know who is behind it. In terms of the Saudis and their capabilities, I addressed that before, but there is something else that I think is very, very important for us to understand. We should be careful what we're asking for here. The last time that the Saudis actually did massive amounts of assistance, military assistance, to a group fighting, and in this case, it's ironic, again, the Russians, was in Afghanistan, and look what we got out of that. We got al-Qaeda out of that. The problem is, exactly, do we really want the export of Wahhabi ideology and Wahhabi groups into Syria? Do we really want Saudi Arabia to cozy up even further in terms of the Syrian population, and particularly with the Muslim Brotherhood in Syria? Do we really want to create this increasingly as a sectarian conflict? This did not begin as a sectarian conflict way back when, about a year ago when it actually began. It was an intersectarian conflict. It was a population against the regime. There was all sorts of intersectarian alliances that were built. But slowly over time, what has gone on has been the protracted nature of the rebellion and the level of state violence on the one hand, and the identification of the regime with the minority community, the Alawite community, on the other hand, has made this into a sectarian conflict. Saudi Arabia moving in, Qatar moving in, both these governments, for example, have supported very, very strongly the Muslim Brotherhood and the Salafists in Egypt and in Tunisia, the Ennahda party in Tunisia. Do we really want further Saudi assistance? Then there's something else that we also have to take into consideration, which is the way Libya turned out. We started out with this idea of we'll have a no-fly zone. And one of my colleagues very, very astutely pointed out that the bottom line in foreign policy has to be the Hippocratic Oath. It has to be first do no harm. What we did was we created a situation that actually escalated the level of violence taking place in Libya. And again, do we really want to see the same sort of thing going on in Syria? I realize that our hearts go out to the opposition at this point. There's no doubt about the worthiness of overthrowing Bashar al-Assad. But on the other hand, the level of bloodshed now that is escalating on a daily basis, how much do we really want to contribute to that?
Well, there's no question that in terms of what the Syrian regime is doing, it's even arrested now the opposition leaders of opposition, the leaders that were calling for a dialogue, the kind of semi-official opposition. They've arrested one of their leaders, and my understanding is that there are even reports of all the Russian defense minister, Alexei Antonov, the deputy defense minister, denied accusations that Russian special forces were operating in Syria. But apparently these new Pantsir interceptor batteries that the Russians have sold the Syrians are being manned by Russians, allegedly to train the Syrians. But that's apparently what General Martin Dempsey was referring to recently before the Senate, when John McCain was saying we want to go in there and bomb them and create air corridors and do what we did in Libya, as you were just pointing out. Dempsey was referring to these new sophisticated Syrian air defenses. Apparently they've been shielding these flights of Iranian planes. So the point's well taken about be careful what you wish for in terms of Saudi aid. But on the other hand, if you look at the what was just revealed from these leaked emails from the Assad's family that CNN have gotten hold of, apart from the dictator's wife ordering shoes from London worth thousands of dollars, she's also it's pretty clear the extent to which the Assad regime is completely reliant on the Iranians.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. I mean, what really fascinated me about the emails actually was the bad taste in 80s music more than anything else. But you're absolutely right in what you pinpoint in terms of the emails. The other thing that you said was absolutely spot on, which is that this is being perceived as a proxy war. The Saudis are not involved in this because they are friends of democracy and human rights, and they want to see democracy and human rights flourish in Syria. The Saudis are involved in this because they see now that, number one, the opposition is not giving up. It has lasted now for close to a year, one day actually under a year in terms of the uprising. They see it as a chance to weaken the Iranian position that had been so strong. And with the Iranians also perceive Syria as being critical as well for a variety of reasons. It's not just that they have a friend in Syria. It's that they have a friend in Hezbollah as well, and Syria is critical. Using Syria is critical for their maintenance of Hezbollah. The uprising so far has had one interesting casualty for Iran, which is that the Iranians had been a major backer of Hamas. And what looks like now is that Hamas has switched sides. It's left Damascus. It's either going to end up in Cairo or Doha. And its finances are no longer going to be in Iranian hands. It's going to be in Qatari hands. So there has been a switch that's taken place. And what we see is this proxy war is being fought out not only in Syria, but it's being fought out in various other places as well. Bahrain, for example, was a very good example of that, where the Saudis and the United Arab Emirates actually invaded to make sure that what they perceived to be a Shi'i-dominated opposition force is not going to take power in Bahrain. And just to remind your listeners that Bahrain is vastly majority Shi'i.
Sure.
And well, taking place in Yemen.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here, James Galvin.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with James Galvin, professor of history at UCLA. His research focuses on the Middle East, particularly Greater Syria, and the area of present-day Syria, Lebanon, Jordan, and Israel, and the Palestinian territories. And he's the author of Divided Loyalties, Nationalism and Mass Politics in Syria at the Close of Empire and the Modern Middle East, A History. This has been a Background Briefing. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbons and assistant producer Nicholas Walrath. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.